Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. With me today by phone is my friend and colleague, Sarah Jane Glynn. She is the guru of women's economic policy here at the Center for American Progress. Sadly, she is not with me in studio because she is in Nashville, and I am massively, massively jealous that she gets to be in Nash Vegas and I am not there with her, it being one of my favorite cities in the United States. But SJ, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
I'm thrilled to be on.
And I have you with me because we are commemorating a particular day of the year, Equal Pay Day. It falls this year on April 12th. What is the significance of that day? What is April 12th about?
So April 12th, 2016 is the date that the average woman would have to work until in order to earn as much money as a man did working in 2015. So because of the differences in men's and women's pay, what we call the gender wage gap, basically women have to work an extra 3.5 months in order to earn what men would earn in a year.
And why is that in 2016, right? We're here in what Back to the Future considered to be the future, right? It was this year. We're here now. Why is this still a thing? And also, while you explain that for us, the number 79, right, 79 cents on the dollar often gets thrown around. What does that mean in terms of how far behind women still are in terms of earning potential in this country?
So I'm so glad you asked me this, because this is one of my favorite things to talk about, is what this 79% figure, 79 cents on the dollar, what it actually means. So like all statistics, it has a backstory that gets erased sometimes. So the 79 cent figure is what you get if you compare the average wages of all women who work full-time year-round to the average wages of all men who work full-time year-round. So it erases a lot of differences between men and women, admittedly. It doesn't account for differences in the types of education that men and women have. For the record, women actually have more education than men nowadays and have for the last several decades. But it also doesn't take into account things like differences in the types of jobs that people have, differences in their work history, differences in whether or not they're members of unions. So there are a lot of differences between the average working man and the average working woman. They get rolled into this 79% figure. And the pushback that I hear sometimes from folks who don't believe the wage gap is a problem is that, oh, well, these differences are because of the quote-unquote choices that women make about their careers, as if women hate money and we're just deciding to make these choices that result in us not having any.
Well, I don't know about you, but I hate money. That's why I work on poverty.
That's why we work in a nonprofit, right? Because we hate money.
That's right. But,
you know, my argument to that is a couple of things. You know, one, these choices don't occur in a vacuum. So there are a lot of things happening, many of which are influenced by public policy in addition to cultural norms, that push women and men in particular types of directions when it comes to family life and career. But also, even when we do account for all of those differences in education, in jobs, work history, et cetera, we still have an unexplainable gap between the wages of men and women. And within all but 5 occupations that are tracked by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, there is a gender wage gap where women earn less than men. So there's a lot of moving pieces here. There's a lot of different things that contribute to the wage gap. Part of it is certainly discrimination, but part of it is these other types of differences in folks' work lives that I think we can explain through public policy.
So what was the Lilly Ledbetter Act about, and why didn't that just fix this problem?
So it's a great question, and the Ledbetter Act was incredibly important, and was notably, you know, the first bill that President Obama signed into law when he took office. So I think that there's a lot of significance around that in terms of this administration's commitment to equal pay. But it was definitely not, you know, a silver bullet to address the wage gap. So what the Ledbetter Act did was change the statute of limitations for folks who are seeking legal redress. So it used to be the courts had decided that the statute of limitations in the Lilly Ledbetter Act had run out. She very famously worked for Goodyear Tire, received an anonymous note telling her that she was getting paid significantly less than her male colleagues, and brought suit. But they threw the suit out because so much time had elapsed since she had been hired. So what the Ledbetter Act did was reset that clock with every paycheck. So every time you get a paycheck that is discriminating against you in terms of your wages, then the statute of limitation resets so that you're less likely to run out of time before you can address the situation. But, you know, that's incredibly important. Certainly, I do not in any way want to diminish what that means in terms of people having the ability to sue employers who are bad actors and receive the back wages that are owed to them. But, you know, that's something that helps people after the fact. That helps people who have already been discriminated against seek justice. But that's not the same thing as addressing things on the front end so that no pay discrimination would happen in the first place, which, you know, I think both pieces are really important. But ideally, we need to have more policies that will prevent women from earning less in the first place instead of just bolstering their ability to go through the courts if they have been.
So what kinds of policies would make a difference to prevent this from happening on the front end?
So there's a broad array of things that can be done to try to help women bring up their wages more on par with what men are earning. You know, like I mentioned, discrimination is a big piece of this. So that's one factor that needs to be addressed and that needs to be addressed legally. There are stronger protections we should have in place to enable folks to go through the court system when they need to. But also things like pay transparency are really important. So right now, many companies have clauses in their handbooks and documentation that workers have to sign saying that they won't discuss their salary with their colleagues. And when people don't know what's happening in terms of pay scales within a company, it makes it very easy for people to be discriminated against. So that's one thing that can be really helpful in trying to address this is promoting better pay transparency. When colleagues want to discuss this with each other, they should have the ability to do so. But there's, you know, there are other things that we can do as well that we tend not to think of within this equal pay frame, but that I would argue are just as important. So things like access to paid leave, for example, access to paid sick days and paid family and medical leave would actually be a really significant step forward in reducing the pay gap, because we know that one of the main reasons why women earn less than men is because they have these long gaps in their work history, which are oftentimes related to family caregiving. So when a woman has a baby, takes several years off because she lost her job because she didn't have access to paid maternity leave, and it takes her several years to re-enter the workforce because childcare is so expensive, now she's got this time gap in her resume that's going to depress her future wages. And so having something like affordable, high-quality childcare and paid leave would help to minimize those gaps, and that would help raise wages for women as well. So, you know, my argument is that we need to have a much more holistic look and thinking about the wage gap, and we need to attack it from all angles, looking at all of the different drivers of it.
Do unions have a role to play here?
Absolutely. You know, we know that part of the wage gap is because women are less likely to be union members than men. And union members, as we know, have better or higher wages and better workplace benefits like access to paid sick days and paid family leave. So unions certainly could go a very long way and are doing a lot to try to help reduce the wage gap as well.
So you talked at the top when you were explaining and unpacking what the 79 cents on the dollar figure means. You made a point of making clear that really does, while it's instructive and helpful to understanding how far we still have to come, it does paper over a lot of the story that's kind of happening underneath that. How does race come into play when we're talking about pay disparities here?
That is also a fantastic question. And the wage
gap. I'm so glad you like all my questions this morning, SJ.
I'm really trying to be more affirming, Rebecca.
I'm feeling so affirmed. I'm going to have you back on the show early and often.
So we know that the wages of women of color are lower than white women's wages. And if you look at the wage gap, again, looking at full-time workers who work year-round, African-American women earn 64% of what white men earn, and for Latinas, it's only 56%. And this adds up to huge losses over the course of a career. The National Women's Law Center just put out some analysis very recently showing that African American women over the course of their career lose nearly $900,000 because of the wage gap. And for Latinas, it's over $1 million. So, you know, I think sometimes the cents on the dollar figures can make us think that we're only talking about pennies here and that it's not significant. But over a lifetime, this adds up to a lot of money. And this happens for a couple different reasons. You know, part of it is because of discrimination. Again, women of color not only face gender discrimination, but also racial or ethnic-based discrimination. And it's also because, you know, women of color get tracked into particular types of jobs. We know that women of color are disproportionately likely to be working in low-wage service jobs. We know that they're disproportionately likely to be working for the minimum wage or less than the minimum wage in terms of tipped workers who, you know, in many states earn only slightly more than $2 an hour. So I think that there are a lot of factors here that disproportionately pile up to have a negative impact on women of color in particular. And that's why, again, I would argue having a broader set of policies to try to address this, raising the minimum wage is another huge piece of this that would have a huge impact on women of color. You know, it's important to focus on things that like the Paycheck Fairness Act, but we also need to think more broadly about, you know, how can we raise wages for women overall? And the ways that would impact not just those working women, but also their families. You know, if we eliminated the wage gap, the poverty rate would be cut in half.
My guest is Sarah Jane Glynn. She is the guru of all things women's economic policy at the Center for American Progress. And next up, really, really excited to have with us Rebecca Traister. She is a writer at large for New York Magazine. She's also the author of the recent book and New York Times bestseller, All the Single Ladies. So stay tuned. You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. In 1960, 60% of Americans were married by age 29. Today, that figure has dropped to just 20%.
What does the rise of the single woman mean economically, socially, politically, and sexually? Is it something to be celebrated or to be feared? Rebecca Traister, a writer at large with New York Magazine, joins us to discuss her New York Times bestseller, All the Single Ladies, which explores these questions and more. Rebecca Traister, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I find it somewhat irresistible to kick off this conversation with Susan B. Anthony, right? early on in the book, you sort of frame her as a prophet, and you quote her at length from what you describe as a clairvoyant speech that she gave in 1877 on single women. And in that speech, you quote her as predicting that, quote, as young women become educated in the industries of the world, thereby learning the sweetness of independent bread, it will be more and more impossible for them to accept the marriage limitations that husband and wife are one. And mm-hmm. And she continues that that this will lead us, quote, inevitably to an epoch of single women. Are we living in that epoch today, and how did we get here?
It is the premise of my book that we are living in that epoch today, and it's, you know, it's going to last a while, and it's, you know, and things are changing all around us. So it's difficult to make firm proclamations about what's going to happen during this epoch. but we got here as part of a long story that actually, you know, was already unfolding in Susan B. Anthony's day in the 19th century and that she was a part of. We have seen since this country's founding, you know, a story of shifting policy around who in this country has access to power, to economic power, to political power, social and sexual and familial power. And so much of that story, as it turns out, as I learned when I was writing my book, is woven around the history of marriage patterns and specifically around women who lived independently from marriage, the institution that organized economic and social and sexual power in this country for a very long time, and increasingly is not the only organizing institution.
And you talk a bit about the shrinking stigma of being single, but it seems like there still remains a stigma. You know, you start with some historical references to the spinster, also Thornback, some of these terms that we hadn't actually heard before. Mm-hmm. But you know, I will often hear single friends talk about being spinsters, and there's even a group in San Francisco called the SF Spinsters. So there seems to be, you know, a shrinking stigma, but still it seems like marriage is the promoted as the goal for women. How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, you see two things happening coterminously and sort of in relationship to each other. As you mentioned at the beginning of the show, this has changed so radically. As long as they kept track of marriage ages for women, the median age of first marriage for women, starting in 1890, which was the first census where they noted it, but we can assume this was true before 1890 as well, until 1980, the median age of first marriage for women only fluctuated between 20 and 22. Marriage to a man was the thing that was to kick off women's adult lives, and there were reasons for it. It is because women were necessarily dependent on men economically. There were so few opportunities for women to have anything resembling economic autonomy or stability on their own. There were very few professions that they could enter, and where they did work, wages were much lower. Gendered and racial wage gaps have existed throughout history and, in fact, been far more severe than they are today. There was simply not much possibility or room for women to live independently of men. Even if women weren't married, they were often dependent on their fathers, brothers, brothers-in-law, for housing, for economic stability, the possibility of living on their own independently, of earning enough money to keep themselves stable was just not a reality. And so marriage was the thing that they necessarily kicked off adult life for women. And of course, it was also an institution that covered reproduction and family making. And so women couldn't have liberated sex lives outside of or in advance of marriage for many years. You know, the possibility of having children outside of marriage, well, it certainly happened, was a very dangerous, economically and socially perilous proposition for women that didn't tend to end well. You know, that remains true until really very recently. And so it makes sense that the median age of first marriage for women was 20 or 22, because it sort of had to be the beginning of adulthood for women. You had to find a man on whom you were going to be dependent. Starting in 1980, as you see some of the real economic and sexual advances of the mid-20th century social movements, feminism, the civil rights movement, certainly the sexual revolution and the legal decisions around Roe v. Wade and Griswold versus Connecticut and I that be Baird that permitted women to exert more reproductive control. When you see the impact of some of those politicized fights, the gay rights movement of the mid to late 20th century begin to take hold and change the conditions for women. By 1980, you see the age of first marriage, which had always been between 20 and 22, by 1990, it jumps to over 23, and today it is over 27, and it is higher than that in many cities, higher than 30 in some places in the United States. And so that is right there, just a massive jump, a massive shift in what the map of female adulthood looks like. That it is now perfectly average to experience an extra 5 years, 10 years, and of course we know in many cases 20 years or entire lifetimes in which you live outside of marriage, and in which there is more opportunity than ever, although that opportunity is unequal, which I'm assuming we're going to be talking about, to gain some kind of economic stability, to enjoy increased educational opportunity, professional opportunity, to have a liberated sex life, you know, to have children outside of marriage. Increasingly, that is a norm as well. More than half of first births to women under 30 are to unmarried women in this country. And so women are no longer dependent on marriage. And therefore, they're doing it later and less often because they don't have to do it anymore.
Well, and Tracy rightly notes that, that the stigma has not entirely gone away, and I wouldn't pretend to argue that it is. As we noted at the top of this episode, Tracy and I are both single women over 30, and you yourself were one. You actually note in the introduction to the book that you married at 35, and that I think I'm getting that right.
Yes.
And that was part of your interest in looking at this. But I would feel remiss if we didn't hearken to some of the sort of setup of your book, where you in one of the book's early chapters, you take the reader back to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearings and to the infamous Anita Hill testimony. She, of course, was the law professor who testified that she had been sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas while she was clerking for him. And she ended up being almost on trial herself when the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee questioned her mental stability and her credibility, in large part because she was a 35-year-old woman who had chosen to pursue a career and to remain single. So clearly a lot has changed.
Yes, and I realized that I was remiss in my last answer. I gave a whole history of single women and didn't explain the second half, which is how, as this becomes a more normalized experience, and really disrupts the way that things have gone before. And Anita Hill is a perfect example of this, because it's threatening when women are living outside of the institution that has historically contained them, and by many measures controlled them, and defined them, and on which they were dependent. When they become independent of that institution, and they become independent in other ways, professionally, economically, they become real threats. And Anita Hill was a perfect example of that, even though in her actual project, which was telling the story of the sexual harassment she experienced whilst a colleague of a nominee to the Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas, he was confirmed despite her testimony. So in that way, she didn't undo him. But the idea that this woman could be a professional peer of, have an equivalent education to, a man who was being nominated for the Supreme Court of the United States, that was pretty threatening in and of itself. The fact that she was unattached from marriage, and this is something that she herself wrote about, interestingly, I didn't realize this until I started writing my book and interviewed her. She herself had written about the role that her single identity played in making her vulnerable to insults and stigma thrown at her by the Senate Judiciary Committee and by critics of what happened. The people on the Senate Judiciary Committee depicted her as perverse, as pathologically lonely, as sexually desperate. David Brock famously referred to her as a little bit slutty and a little bit nutty. She was made extra suspect by the fact that she was unmarried. And so, but it's interesting that the thing I was going to say about the stigma persisting and in some ways intensifying as women live independent of marriage in greater numbers is that in part that's the reaction. On the one hand, it's becoming a much more normalized experience so that, for example, your friends who call themselves the San Francisco spinsters can adopt and reappropriate language that had been diminishing historically and have a sense of humor about it because their experience is increasingly normalized. At the same time, the pressures, the threat that the normalization of single life for women creates means that people who are upset about it, threatened by it, confused by it, get increasingly agitated and want to punish those women even more. And so what you see are increasing messages about fetishizing weddings, for example, the rise of the wedding industrial complex, the say yes to the dress, the social media obsession with, you know, engagement ring shots and wedding photos and all that kind of stuff. It can feel like the pressure to marry and to consider marriage as the peak achievement of female adulthood. Anachronistically, it can feel like that's building even as marriage becomes less and less the peak achievement of female adulthood, if that makes any sense.
And I think a compounding effect of the Anita Hill situation is that this was a woman of color. And you talk about the issues of intersectionality within singledom. Obviously, she was economically privileged, but there are differences between how women of color, how poor women are seen in this country. And you write that while the victories of independent life are often emblematized by the country's most privileged women, the war was fought by many Americans who have always had far fewer options to live free, women of color, poor, and working class women. And you know, how do these, I guess, the shift really play out? Because, again, you note that there's a fetishization of marriage, but that's of a much more privileged class with, you know, the rings and the dresses and all of that. But, you know, the liberation of the single women has largely been from people who need more freedom.
Well, it started with people who had far less freedom and opportunity to begin with, and who often were walking away from marriage, not even walking away from marriage, not marrying less often and later, in response to economic challenge. So in the current iteration of this, if you look at the history, in the middle of the 20th century, the very famous story of the mid-20th century America, the sort of emblematic story, is one of the rise of the white middle class, the post-depression, post-war white middle class, buildup of the nuclear family in which domestic servility was kind of enforced for middle-class white women. And the government funded all these, the creation of these suburbs and the building of these houses and the building of highways that would connect white men from their jobs in the urban centers to their government-subsidized housing in the new suburbs. After servicemen returned from the war, white returning servicemen were far more able to take advantage of the GI Bill that would send them to college. Black returning servicemen were far less able to do so because they were far less likely to be admitted to colleges. All these same mechanisms that were helping to build and help the white middle class flourish in the United States in the mid-20th century were cutting off black families from a lot of the same resources, so that those highways were being built through black neighborhoods and cutting black neighborhoods off from the urban centers where there were jobs and opportunity. Of course, many of those government subsidized, and this is something that Tom Sugrue and Ta-Nehisi Coates have done a lot of writing about, and I cite them in my book, that those white suburbs were built exclusively for white families, and black families were excluded from them. Black neighborhoods were redlined. Black homebuyers were charged usurious mortgage rates. The possibility for building that kind of nuclear mid-20th century middle-class family was actually made totally inaccessible to black families. And in the face of this economic challenge, marriage began to make much less sense. If there aren't jobs, if there aren't homes in which jobs to be hired for and homes in which you can move and, public schools that are going to educate your children well, then this aspirational, middle-class nuclear family, patriarchal male earner and a domestic, unpaid wife at home to do the child care makes much less sense. It's just not tenable. And so what you saw was a drop in black marriage rates in the 1950s moving into the 1960s. And it came not only at the same time, but in relationship to the buildup of the white middle class that was in many other ways cutting white women off from opportunities that they'd had in the early 20th century. And so what you get in 1963, you get Study for Dance with Feminine Mystique, which was very famously, the sort of explosive feminist cry out of those suffocating white middle-class suburbs for women. And in 1965, you get the Moynihan Report, which was the report on systemic black poverty, which in many ways was a very thoughtful document and documentation of the history of systemic inequality experienced by African Americans. But in another way, it sort of circled around this one center of what Moynihan saw as pathology, which was women-headed households, single women, single black women. And so it's impossible. In the mid-20th century, it was black women who stopped marrying first in response to economic conditions. You can see this. And then when that behavior, because it does, it then displaces marriage as the institution that organizes gendered power. And when that behavior begins to spread to more privileged communities, and get repeated by more privileged people who have more resources with which to make their independence look attractive and, in fact, be more appealing, then it becomes discernible as liberation. So then you get Sex and the City. And that is a pattern that is repeated often in America's history. I mean, working for wages outside the home. Obviously, women who have worked for wages outside the home have been poor and working class women throughout history out of necessity, and often women of color. But, and of course, working outside the home for wages, while incredibly difficult and physically taxing, in many cases dangerous, and low paid, and, it also has offered, and this is something that Sadie Alexander wrote about in the early 20th century in advance of Betty Friedan, it also offered women kinds of satisfaction, kinds of economic power. It was Sadie Alexander, who was a black lawyer in Philadelphia, was arguing that this was good for women and good for their families. She was arguing this in advance of Betty Friedan, and she was arguing it about women of color who had long worked outside the home for wages. When that behavior, which did offer women many benefits, got repeated by women who had more resources to start with and more privilege to start with, then it becomes discernible as the feminist revolution of the 1970s, women moving into workplaces. So this is a pattern of an appropriation of behavior that is often enacted in response to challenging economic conditions. But when it is mimicked by women with more resources, it becomes legible to us as political revolution. But it's often women of color who are the pioneers of these behaviors, and that is true for the changing marriage patterns as well. And yet we still continue to look on women of color as victims, and the white women who repeat their behaviors as, you know, political groundbreakers.
And I want to dig a little bit into that, right? So I love the way that you put this in one portion of the book. You say that, quote, privileged women no more invented liberation from marriage than they invented the idea of working to earn wages, which I feel like so beautifully captures exactly what you've just been articulating and sort of tracing back throughout time. But I want to dig a little bit into that that clash that very much still exists today, right? It didn't go the way of the Moynihan Report in the rearview mirror. It's very much still with us today, which is our society historically, but still very much today, blaming many, if not all, of our social ills on women, but particularly women of color, and particularly women who are single mothers of color. And we see that a lot in the politics of how we talk and think about poverty and how we talk and think about welfare.
Right. Well, this is one of the things that I argue in my book that I think conservatives will take strong exception to. It is conservative dogma that the way to address poverty is through a reinstatement of early heteromarriage as a social norm. And they say this very directly in a million different ways. They say it's like shooting fish in a barrel to get one of them saying it. Marco Rubio has said, we have a program that will end poverty. It's called marriage. Mitt Romney, when asked in a 2012 debate against Barack Obama what would stem the tide of gun violence, said people should get married. He has given commencement speeches urging young people to marry, not just more often, but early. So you see, I mean, this is, it really is. It's just pervasive. This is the pervasive idea of conservatives that, because it is true that that unmarried mothers in particular face very high rates of poverty. 42% of single mothers live below the poverty line. Half of minimum wage workers are single women, many of them mothers. This is the kind of thing that is a national crisis. But the fix, as we know, right, we live in a country that is riven by economic inequality. But for conservatives, the fix is reestablish marriage. I believe the absolute opposite of this. I believe that we need to better economically bolster through, you know, expanded welfare programs, expanded healthcare benefits, expanded revised social policies, raised minimum wage, that if we provide more stable economic conditions for the United States, that's the approach to alleviating poverty. And that as a side benefit, it will likely, I don't much care whether it improves marriage rates. I have no investment in whether people marry more or less, but I certainly think that economic stability makes for more stable relationships between people and more stable families and more stable kids. And so to me, it is self-evident. And in fact, there are actually programs. One of the interesting things is that, you know, the United States has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on the Healthy Marriage Initiative, which was started in the Bush administration. It was meant to encourage marriage and educate people about marriage and encourage early marriage. And it was meant to be, in part, an approach to poverty. And it was continued by the Obama administration, although it changed and emphasized education about parenting more. But it had no impact on it did nothing to raise marriage rates at all. And the only public policy approaches that have actually shown signs of boosting marriage rates and marriage longevity are ones that expanded welfare benefits. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, there was an anti-poverty program called the New Hope Project. And it was in the mid-90s, and it provided full-time workers whose earnings were below 150% of the federal poverty level with income supplements, and offered those who were unable to find work community service jobs and subsidized health care. The study of marriage rates showed that 21% of never-married women who participated in that project were married 5 years later, compared to 12% of never-married women who did not participate. In Minnesota, the Minnesota Family Investment Program allowed people to keep their welfare benefits as opposed to cutting them off after they found jobs, and the divorce rate for black women in the state fell by 70%. So there's actually evidence, even though my interest is not in raising marriage rates, so that seems to be the interest of many conservatives. But it seems self-evident to me that marriage becomes untenable in economically challenged circumstances, and that if we created through social programs, as we know we have the ability to do by creating more robust welfare benefits, by offering Americans with no safety net a much stronger safety net, you're going to see increased stability, which increases the ability of adult human beings to have stable relationships.
And a point that a colleague of ours, Sean Fremstad, whom you know often...
Good work I admire so much.
And he would say the same of you. We'll channel him here for you. A point he often makes and which just needs to be said again and again so that people stop just hearing the all the quotes you mentioned, right? Marriage is the panacea to everything in the world.
Right.
Is that there are more married people in poverty in this country than never married people.
Right.
And sort of a continuation of that conservative line of thinking is one that you take down really explicitly in the book, which is that single women are somehow looking for the government to create a, quote, hubby state for them. You argue that actually what we've long had in this country is a wifey state for men. What do you mean by that? And how does that tie in with sort of the conservative line of thinking about marriage as the be-all and end-all?
Well, one of the things that conservatives who want to reinstate this early marriage model say over and over again is that single women want these changed social policies, whether that's subsidized daycare, paid leave, higher minimum wages, paid sick days, in part because they want to rely on government benefits they want to rely on Uncle Sam as their husband. This is something you hear from conservatives all the time, talking derisively about unmarried women voters and why they vote Democratic, because Democrats support the social programs that make more sense. And, you know, to some extent, by the way, they are right that unmarried women need better support from the government, and support in part in place of what used to exist as the, you know, when marriage was the organizing principle of adult life. But the problem with this is that this portrays women's need for support from the government as aberrant, as pathetic, when in fact men, and specifically white men in this country, have benefited from government support from the founding, whether that's come in the form of their right to vote, which was established at the founding for white men and has been protected ever since, whereas we know for women and people of color, it took centuries of death and fighting it in order to be able to get the vote. White men have, from the beginning of this country, had the ability to select a government that best represented their needs and served their needs. White men have benefited from educational loans, from housing subsidies, from tax breaks, from the building of the infrastructure that as the people, the class of Americans that ran the businesses and profited from them, you know, the United States invested in the infrastructure that permitted those businesses to thrive. White men have benefited hugely from the government, and what's more, they have benefited from the government's refusal to put in place similar protections for women, so that women's equal pay is not protected. There are still massive gendered and racial wage gaps that keep women's pay much lower than men's. There are not programs that support women's participation in the workforce, things like paid leave after the birth of children, or paid leave for, you know, in the case of a gravely ill relative, where it's still women who are we still expect that there is a class of American wives who are not working, who are at home, who are going to take care of these things, who's going to pick up children at 3 o'clock in the afternoon or take care of them through our long summer breaks. Our country is organized around the idea that there is one kind of American, the husband, who is out in the public world having professional, economic, and political power, and that there's one kind of American, wives, who are is at home doing the domestic and child care and enabling the husband's participation in the public sphere. And we're not organized that way anymore. And so it is absolutely true that women now require more support from the government. But it is a support that would only begin to get them up to speed with the kind of support that men have gotten. Because in depressing women's the ability for women to experience economic equality, you have also kept women off the playing field. You have basically left it open for men, and again, white men, to run their own table, to not have women competing with them for jobs until very recently, or for education until very recently. And in fact, women working to support their participation in the public sphere. And so men have benefited in every direction, white men, from government support for centuries. So when we suggest that women now should benefit from government support, I think that's only fair.
And another component of this war on women that we're seeing in public policy goes back to reproductive rights, which you mentioned earlier, marriage being an institution that was in part there to govern women's reproductive lives. But we've seen, you know, with the rise in Supreme Court cases and horrible legislation across the country, attempts to roll back women's rights and access to abortion and birth control. Do you see this as part of a backlash to the rise in single women?
Oh yeah, the backlash is intense, and I think that you're going to see it coming from pretty much every direction. There's going to be this emphasis, and this has happened in the past, and in my book I trace the history of the ways that when backlash came to women living independently, it came from every direction. You know, it's easy to conceive of backlash, you know, somebody says, oh, come on, it's not like there's, you know, one person sitting there saying, I'm going to reinstall women in the home, you know, and make them economically dependent on men again. It's actually all kinds of forces working at once. And I think that the backlash that contemporary single women are facing that is very real is because there is so much conservative investment in reestablishing marriage as the organizing norm. What you have is a real risk, because if you take away women's reproductive rights, which we know is happening around the country, if you do not protect their rights to equal pay, if you do not offer them support in the form of paid leave benefits, paid sick days, and of course all of these positions are ones that the Republican Party supports. If the Republican Party comes to even more power, they already have terrific power federally and in state legislatures around the country. If they gain more power, for example, in 2016 and then in 2020 and in, 2018, as Republicans gain more power, they really do have the power to make women to roll back the kinds of pieces of social progress that created the conditions that enable women to live outside of marriage. So if you roll back women's abilities to control their reproductive lives and make decisions about when and if and under what circumstances to have children, if you roll back their chances of educational and economic equality, which you do by, doing away with affirmative action in part, if you roll back their voting rights, which you do by gutting the Voting Rights Act, here are some examples of how this is happening, you can recreate economic circumstances in which women don't have economic and social and sexual autonomy any longer, and it will force them to again be dependent on men and on marriage. So it's not like there's a degree to which backlash takes the forms of the messages in magazines and Steve Harvey yelling, in his case particularly at black women, about their empowerment and how it's going to leave them without husbands, and you have the all kinds of punishing pop culture messages that are still out there and the fetishization of yes, say yes to dress. But then you also have the very real political reality, which is that it is possible to make women dependent on marriage again, and that we could be an election or two or three or four away from a return to circumstances that would, again, make it very difficult for women to live outside of marriage.
Well, and in the last minute that we have with you, just sort of on that political note, you actually titled one of your chapters, Single Women Have Often Made History. And you sort of walk through how throughout history, women who, as you put it, who contrived to remain single often found themselves better able than their married counterparts to exercise some control over their own fates and thus to leave their marks on the world. As we look ahead to the epoch that we're in, but then the years to follow and the generations to follow, what do you expect to be the political and the policy and the societal consequences of this rise in single women?
Well, it depends very much on whether or not we elect progressive Democrats or whether we elect Republicans, and not just to the presidency, but at state and local levels around the country. I mean, that's what we see around especially abortion rights restrictions, voting rights restrictions, is that a lot of this rollback is enacted on local levels. So this means really thinking about top to bottom elections and the kinds of policies that we want to see passed. And in one version of the story, which I feel optimistic about, in fact, just today, the New York State Legislature is finalizing a budget that may, in fact, include not only a minimum wage hike to $15, which would disproportionately have an impact on unmarried women and single mothers, single parents, but also potentially the most robust paid leave program yet enacted in the country. I am optimistic about these things happening. If you see more policies like that, that are going to, around the country and eventually, I hope, federally, that would mandate increased support for unmarried women, that's going to be the good version of the story. And that's what I'm optimistic that we're going to see. We now see things like higher minimum wage, paid leave, paid sick days on the agendas of both presidential candidates, and increasingly a Democratic Party that's responded to that. The nightmare version is what I laid out a minute ago, is that we just continue to elect Republicans at all levels of government and that they will work to strip away the rights that create the possibility of women living outside of marriage. And that is what we're going to be seeing in coming decades.
Rebecca Traister is the author of the New York Times bestseller, All the Single Ladies. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And as two single ladies who are loving your book right now, we'll let Beyonce take us out.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrel from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis, and we are Tracy-less for this week's Weekly Worst, but that's okay, because we have Alyssa Peterson, our fearless executive producer, standing in for the great Tracy Ross.
Highlight of my week.
Highlight of mine, too. And as usual, if not always, we have Alan Pike, the king of the Weekly Worst.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, hello. So, Alan, what do you have for us this week?
First up, Kansas lawmakers are looking to kick their Supreme Court justices out of office.
How did I know it was going to be Kansas?
Kansas keeps
Kansas
doing
is
bad
the gift
stuff,
that keeps
man.
On giving.
We do a bit about places that do bad stuff, and there's Kansas.
You know, I was actually literally having a conversation. I was having a conversation, not to interrupt you, but totally to interrupt you. I was having.
It is your show.
I mean, it is. I am in the controlled seat right now. Having a conversation yesterday with a friend of mine who is from another state than Kansas, and was talking about all the bad shit that's happening in that state that I will not name to spare it the honor of being mentioned in the Weekly Worst. And I was like, but hey, at least there's Kansas. And he kind of paused and he was like, you're right.
Oh my God.
So that's the silver lining of Kansas.
Sure.
So please proceed
yeah, no,
with Kansas.
They're really setting a good bar for the
country.
So latest fun twist in what's been going on in Kansas over the last couple of years is that a bunch of people in the state legislature are looking to kick the justices on the state Supreme Court out of office. Not because they've been, you know, philandering with other people's wives or doing cocaine off of each other's, like, collarbones on the job or whatever.
They might have been. We just don't know.
Right. That hasn't been proven.
To our knowledge.
Nor am I alleging it here.
Right, right. To our knowledge, that has not happened,
right.
Listeners.
The actual reason is that the judges keep pointing out that the budgets that the legislature passes are illegal. And the lawmakers are sort of getting a little bit cheesed about how every year they say, we're going to underfund education by a couple hundred million dollars statewide. Cool? Cool? Cool?
Yep.
Okay, everybody over here thinks it's cool. And then the Supreme Court in the state says, deeply uncool and also violates our state constitution. Can't do this. This has happened repeatedly, going back to, I think, 2010, which, not at all coincidentally, is when Governor Sam Brownback was elected and began pushing for massive tax cuts that are structured to primarily benefit wealthy people in the state, and that, best of all, completely eliminated income taxes for a huge category of quote-unquote small businesses that's so loosely defined that literally, like, individual taxpayers can change themselves to be an S-corp and suddenly avoid all income taxes. It's they're hemorrhaging money.
While
it's
simultaneously, of course, increasing the tax burden on lower-income
yes.
Right.
Kansans.
Yes.
Right. Both getting a greater share of the state's revenue from poor people and not having enough money to literally, like, there are stories about schools in Kansas where the nurse has no ice packs but a sponge in the freezer.
Oh, God.
To replace an ice pack and things like that.
Sounds so like a win-win to me if I'm brown back.
Early, like, cut the academic year short.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting because he is sort of the conservative dream boy. He gets floated out as, like, this brilliant, amazing tax proposal.
He's today's Reagan.
Yes, he's today's Reagan. Except even moderate conservatives in his own party jumped ship to try to oust him, failed, and then you have a conservative state Supreme Court saying, even this is crazy. That, I mean, that should trigger a wake-up call.
Isn't it also Kansas where conservatives have realized that they haven't had success at outlawing abortion in the way that they want in the state? And they're like, you know, in the Supreme Court, not doing what we want here. So maybe we need to, like, find ways to pack the court with people who will try to do things that are actually in violation of Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, the court overturned a bill to restrict access to reproductive autonomy.
The shame! The thought!
I think also a same-sex marriage decision that the legislature didn't like. This has been going on. The tension's been escalating for a couple of years. And earlier this year, the legislature basically tried to cut funding for the justice system in its own state. All that stuff, it's a great, like, you know, it overturns all that stuff we learned in, like, second grade civics or whatever about...
Did you take civics in second grade?
I don't know why I said second grade civics.
Because you wanted to impress us.
You were clearly not in a Kansas public school.
I don't know.
You didn't have any icy sponges in your school.
I think we were doing multiplication tables. Is that a second grade thing?
I think we need to go on to the next story. So that's Kansas, in a nutshell.
Second story is that the average price of insulin has tripled since 2002, according to new medical research. This is a story that my colleague Alex Zelensky wrote for thinkprogress.org. The average U.S. diabetes patient was paying $231 a year for her insulin in 2002. By 2013, the yearly cost was $736 on average. And obviously, we already know that people living in poverty are at a far greater risk of developing diabetes.
Well, I mean, I'm just thinking about how this is, if you're in the Medicaid gap and you can't access coverage, how are you supposed to I mean, and obviously conservatives have not squared with that reality. Like I did some reporting for Talk Poverty where South Carolina, there's a county that has the highest rate of diabetic amputations. And that is not a coincidence given that this is the same state that has not expanded Medicaid. So you can only imagine like looking at that county, how the price of insulin increasing is only going to increase the collateral consequences on low-income people in that state.
Yeah, there's such a connection between not just access to health insurance, but poverty and disability, right? I hate every time I have to even say this sentence out loud, but disability is a cause and a consequence of poverty in this country. And preventive care, and diabetes is such a great example, is hugely, hugely important, both to help people from actually experiencing poor health, but also to help them manage conditions like diabetes that need ongoing management and care and medicine like insulin. And when people can't access what they need, they get sicker and sicker and sicker, and they can end up in the position of literally losing limbs, like Alyssa described. Just because they can't afford basic medicines that science has produced for us. So I'm horrified and also just totally, totally unsurprised.
Yeah, the last thing I want to say on this is rest in peace, Fife Dog.
Oh, God.
Third story.
On that note.
He was diabetic.
I know.
So speaking of drugs, our third nominee this week is Pfizer, the American drug giant. They're going to have to find some other way to shift their tax headquarters outside of the United States after the Obama administration announced new rules for American companies that merge with international firms in order to avoid taxes this week. The 160-year-old drug maker decided to cancel its planned merger with Ireland-based Allergan. But Pfizer's likely to try again. This is the second time in the last, I think, 2 years that they've tried to do what's called an inversion, where they pretend to have moved to Ireland or Luxembourg or the British Virgin Islands or some other low tax jurisdiction, just for tax purposes. They leave their physical production operations, their research and development operations, all that stuff remains basically the same. Again, this is a company that was founded 160 years ago in Brooklyn with like $2,500 loan from the guy's father. And that's become this massive success globally, in part because it's been, you know, nuzzled into the bosom of American capitalism and all the things that public resources go toward to make success stories like that possible.
And a heck of a bosom that is.
It's, I mean, have you seen Lady Liberty? Stacked. They've had the success they've had in large part because they've benefited from the sort of the shelter from economic turbulence that the American public provides by building roads, funding schools, except in Kansas. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And now they want to leave because they don't want to pay their tax bill.
And you know what they all said collectively while they were sitting in the boardroom making that decision? Thanks, Obama.
Oh, God.
In unison.
Yeah, I mean, that's just bad. Like, given the Panama Papers and now this, it's like, oof. Yeah. Don't you think the super wealthy should, like, just chill out for a bit?
So I have to add an honorary fourth nominee, like, in, like, 2 seconds here that was sent to our awareness by a colleague here at CAP. Apparently, earlier this week at a hearing that the Senate Banking Committee held on the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and its future, because we know that Republicans love the CFPB. A particular senator, Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina, who gained recent fame by teaming up with Paul Ryan for the anti-poverty summit that they hosted a bunch of presidential candidates at, he actually said at the hearing that Dodd-Frank has made poverty worse. A classic moment. So I wanted to just add that into the mix as well.
That's fun. That is. I'm really curious what he means by that. I got to go find what the hell he's. I guess he probably means like it's probably a rehash of the same inaccurate, factually incorrect talking points about the CFPB having made it harder for people to get loans of various kinds, like restricted access to credit.
Here's the quote of what he said. And then we have to vote. He said, "For the average person in the average place in this country who suffers on a daily basis because of financial stress, the facts are very simple. As a kid growing up, just by circumstance, I went to 4 different elementary schools because poverty has a transient nature. You move a lot. And so when I think about the impact of Dodd-Frank, I think about the impact of Dodd-Frank on the poor very specifically. And to me, it's pretty clear. The facts are clear that Dodd-Frank makes it worse for people living in poverty and people living on the threshold of poverty." I mean, you can't argue with that, right? He's made the case so strongly.
Dear God.
That's like two true things and then a thing that just like it's like two chicken eggs and then a balloon full of helium.
Yep.
So I just had to add that. So we have to vote. I have to vote for Kansas. I'm sorry.
Oh yeah.
I can't not vote for Kansas.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think my vote was in the bag, given our like first 5 minute discussion of Kansas. Oh yeah.
Because it wasn't even one thing. We like piled nine things
for the icy
Kansas.
Sponge for just the variety of things. Kansas.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's, Alan.
No, you have a protest. Don't apologize. No, I'm not going to this time.
Is it unanimous?
Yeah.
Yes.
Kansas.
What's the matter with Kansas?
Yes.
The answer is everything.
Because you don't get to Try to make policy, get told by a co-equal branch of government, I see what you're after, but you gotta change this, this, and this so that it's legal, and then go, oh yeah, you're fired. Like, that's not how it works. That's not America. However old I was when I learned civics, I learned that we're supposed to have three branches of government that keep each other from being dicks. And you don't get to just fire the guy who's telling you that you're being a dick so you can keep being a dick.
Well, I'm rubber and you're glue, and this is Talk Poverty Radio.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.